The suspect emerged from his garage and fired his weapon. An officer returned fire, striking the suspect in the torso.
A man is shot and killed by Anchorage police after firing on his neighbor. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 21st. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, the Pebble Project takes a significant step forward.
Now we're going to be able to have a debate about exactly what we're proposing to do, and I think that'll be pretty healthy.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you.
A man is dead after an officer-involved shooting in Anchorage last night, the fourth such incident this year. The male suspect was shot after firing a handgun at a neighbor at a Midtown Anchorage condo complex. The Anchorage Police Department isn't identifying the suspect until his family is notified. APD Deputy Chief Kenneth McCoy says that at about 10 p.m. last night, the suspect tried entering the victim's condo.
Our investigation has shown the suspect broke that window with his firearm by force.
The man fled, and the victim, an unidentified adult woman, called a maintenance worker contracted with the condo to address the broken window. At around 11:20, the suspect emerged from his garage and fired on the victim and the maintenance worker. The victim fled into her home and called police. She and the worker were unharmed. McCoy says the officers showed up within minutes, set up a perimeter, and began a search.
The suspect emerged from his garage and fired his weapon. An officer returned fire, striking the suspect in the torso.
The man was pronounced dead at the scene. Only one officer fired on him. No other officers or civilians were harmed. Authorities say they're still investigating the motive, and in keeping with APD policy, the officer who shot the suspect is currently on paid leave and will be identified 3 days after the incident. This is the fourth officer-involved shooting in Anchorage this year and the second fatal one. Meanwhile, an Anchorage Crime Stoppers tip and DNA led to arrests Wednesday in Juneau for an Anchorage murder case that had gone cold for years. A grand jury indicted two Juneau men, each on one count of second-degree murder in the death of Jerry Dillivan. Dillivan was 25 when he was killed in 1995. 49-year-old Dwayne Price and 44-year-old Brown Willard III are being held at the Lemon Creek Correctional Center in Juneau. The Alaska Department of Law says that on the morning of November 21st in 1995, Dillivan was found beaten to death behind a Texaco station in East Anchorage. Price and Willard face sentences of up to 99 years in prison. Backers of a controversial proposed mine in southwest Alaska are taking another significant step forward. Pebble Limited Partnership has announced that tomorrow it'll apply for a federal Clean Water Act permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. It's the first of many permit applications Pebble needs to file before it can build the proposed copper and gold mine. But it's still a triumph for its sponsors. With this, Pebble will have checked off all three goals it wanted to accomplish this year: a settlement with the Environmental Protection Agency, a new financial partner, and a permit application. Tom Collier is Pebble's CEO, and he says he's pleased.
Now we're going to be able to have a debate about exactly what we're proposing to do, and I think that'll be pretty healthy for resolving all the various disagreements about the project.
The permit application triggers the federal environmental review process. Agencies will use that process to determine whether the mine should be approved. It also means more detailed plans on the mine's design will soon be made public. For environmental groups fighting the mine, it's a dramatic turn from just a year ago, when the Obama administration had proposed Clean Water Act restrictions that threw the mine's future into question. Back then, EPA said it was responding to widespread local concern that the mine could harm the Bristol Bay salmon fishery. Alana Hurley is executive director of United Tribes of Bristol Bay. She says the mine is harder to fight once the permitting process begins, but not impossible.
We're very confident that we will be able to defeat this project within the permitting process. because you cannot change the fact that this type of development will devastate the Bristol Bay fishery.
Just this Monday, Pebble announced it secured a new partner for the mine, the Canadian company First Quantum Minerals. Pebble's leadership says First Quantum Minerals' investment in the project will help fund it through the permitting process. Pebble hopes to complete permitting in 3 to 5 years. The state's Department of Environmental Conservation is calling for comments on its newest water quality report. The report is part of the Federal Clean Water Act program that requires each state to develop plans to fix water bodies that have been polluted. Each time the state puts out one of these lists, there's good news and there is bad news. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more on the bad news for one of the most heavily used rivers in the state.
If there were a popularity contest for rivers in Alaska, judging by the thousands of people who visit the Kenai River every year, it would probably win. Anglers zip around in motorboats looking for the perfect fishing holes, or they wriggle into their waders and cast from the shoreline, or they just stand in the river mouth holding these long-poled nets shoulder to shoulder by the hundreds. This year, Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation put out a new water quality report. It's essentially a federally mandated report card of rivers, lakes, and water bodies in the state that people have polluted. And the Kenai River? It's getting a failing grade. The state is recommending that it be put on a federal list of polluted waterways. Jack Sinclair is the executive director of the Kenai Watershed Forum. As part of the study that got the river listed, he sat at one spot on the river for 12 hours, counting boats.
It was 2,000 boats that passed. That's not the number of boats that were on the river, but that's how many passes took place along that stretch.
Each of those 2,000 passes muddies up the water. And that's exactly what the state says is wrong on the Kenai. The river doesn't meet the state's water quality standards for turbidity. Turbidity is a measurement of cloudiness. The simplest way to think of it is like smog in the water. And a smoggy river is not good for anything living in it. And it's not good for people, for drinking, swimming, or fishing. The Kenai isn't the only river in the state having this problem. This year's report adds the Little Susitna River in the Matsu Borough to the impaired list for the same turbidity problem. And once a river is listed as impaired, it kicks off a process at the state and federal level that requires that the water be cleaned, or in this case, cleared. Cindy Gilder is a section manager with the state's Division of Water.
It is a year's process. Some of that is driven by how difficult is the problem to solve, and what's the commitment by the community?
There are three levels of pollution standards. The first, and easiest to violate, is whether there's enough pollution to make the water unsafe for people to drink. The second is recreation. Is the water safe to be in, clear enough to fish in? And the last and hardest to violate is the standard for the safety of wildlife and fish. The Kenai River violates drinking water and recreational standards. But should a popular sport fishing river be required to meet drinking water standards? Ricky Geese is the executive director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association, and he says it shouldn't.
Not too many people for a thirst of clear water would hunker down to the Kenai any place along that section and grab a glass of water to drink because it's all cloudy, it's filthy, it probably wouldn't be very good for you.
While he doesn't agree with the state's standards, Geese does have several ideas for things that can be done to lower the turbidity on the water. Most all of them involve reducing boat traffic. Right now, fishing guides get their own special time on the river to take clients out. That means a lot of boat traffic hits the river at the same time.
Do you call it a shotgun start? Maybe doing away with that, getting some other regulations for guide hours so everybody's not starting at the exact same time.
Or, he says, get people out of their boats and let them fish from shore. State environmental scientists like this. They like it when the people who use the river come up with ways to change their habits for the health of the river. The state's report is still in draft form, which means some things could change. They're taking public comments until January 29th. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, if you think it's been a warm winter, you are not alone.
If you look at the extended forecast out 8, 10, 14 days, which takes us through the end of the year, it's really looking quite warm, you know, way above normal.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Support for Public Radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station.
Congress passed a short-term spending bill today that includes one longer-term project for Alaska. The bill allocates $200 million to build a fourth field of underground silos at Fort Greeley near Fairbanks. The Trump administration requested the expansion at Fort Greeley last month. It's part of a larger campaign to beef up the nation's missile defenses to counter the North Korean threat. The new field is intended to house 20 additional missile interceptors. That would bring the total number of ground-based interceptors there to 60. The funding is available until 2022. The silo field was also included in the annual defense policy bill Congress passed. Today's short-term spending bill avoids a government shutdown, but it only continues funding for most programs until January 19th. Congress needs to pass another spending bill before then. For now, though, lawmakers have left the Capitol for Christmas break. In a move several decades in the making, two of the main energy providers in South Central Alaska could soon become one. In presentations today, Chugach Electric Association outlined a proposal to acquire Municipal Light and Power under an arrangement worth more than $1 billion. But not without several rounds of approval from regulators, representatives, and residents. Standing next to leaders from Chugach, Mayor Ethan Berkowitz sketched out the reasons why the municipality thinks it's worth selling off the city's electric utility.
This is a momentous occasion, and it's momentous because a lot of people over a long period of time have worked hard to get us to this point. This is not to say we are at the end of the process, but it is a process that will yield great benefits for the ratepayers and the taxpayers and the municipality, and we're pleased to be part of it.
Earlier this year, the city's assembly authorized the administration to look into options for selling ML&P or merging it with another utility. The general terms of this sale involved Chugach borrowing money to pay off $542 million of ML&P's debt. Other payments over the next 30 years bring the total sale price to over $1 billion. Chugach's CEO, Lee Thiebert, says if the sale goes through, it won't change utility rates right away, but will start to gradually reduce people's monthly electric bills over time.
In short, we will reduce duplication on many fronts. We will take advantages of economies of scale, and everything becomes part of the cooperative business structure, which is member-owned.
The administration and electric utilities say the deal will not lead to layoffs. The two entities have collaborated on energy projects in recent years and frame the sale in terms of a progression in that relationship. Both Chugach and the administration say there are good reasons for moving ahead with the deal now. Interest rates are low, making it relatively cheap for Chugach to borrow money. Both utilities are anticipating declining demand in coming years from more efficient technologies, and Berkowitz says it makes sense for the city to shed liability at a time when the economic outlook is uncertain.
We live in a state right now that's having a hard time wrestling with its fiscal situation. I think there's a risk in doing nothing and being passive in the face of their inactivity. One of the things that we're doing here is insulating Anchorage from the effects of the state's fiscal problems. The more we can stimulate business, the more we can insulate ourselves, the more we can have control of our own fate, I think the stronger off we're going to be.
If the Anchorage Assembly approves the deal, voters will weigh in on the proposal in the April 3rd election. There is no good reason why a city the size of Anchorage needs two competing utilities, both generating roughly the same amount of power. The duplication is mostly just an accident of history. Chris Rose with the Renewable Energy Alaska Project says combining companies together can lead to greater efficiencies.
It will be important for us to look at the details and for obviously the two independent utilities, Chugach and MLP, to look at the details for their own ratepayers. But generally speaking, it looks like this is going to be a good deal for the railroad.
Assuming the assembly and voters opt to go forward, the deal would still need to be approved by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Chugach thinks the sale could ultimately go through in early 2019. Regulators voted to slash Gulf of Alaska Pacific cod allocations 80% earlier this month after a massive decline in stocks. That has fishermen and processors around the Gulf deciding what to do when the season kicks off in January. KBBI's Aaron Bolton has more.
Yeah, it's going to be a big deal to quite a bunch of us. I'm guessing we're going to be looking for stuff to do by end of February at the latest.
Alleray Carroll works as an engineer for Bering Marine Corporation in the summer. But during the winter months, he fishes for Pacific cod in state waters near Kachemak Bay. Pacific cod fishing is Alaska's second largest fishery by volume, bringing in $186 million in 2015. And the fishery is open during a time when there's not much else going on. Once 2018's total allowable catch of 13,000 metric tons has been landed, the season is over. And that may have some looking for work to get them through the winter. Next year's numbers also have some fishermen wondering if it might be better to just wait for other fisheries to open. But Carroll says he still plans on fishing.
You know, it won't be any different. It'll just be shorter. Last year we fished from December until 8th of April or something like that. So it was a long season. This one's going to be pretty fast and furious. I'm thinking the federal pot quota will be caught within 3 weeks, and the state water pot quota won't, I don't think it'll last a month.
Others aren't so sure. Eric Velsko fishes for Pacific cod, but also targets halibut and sablefish, which usually ramp up in March. Velsko also uses his boat as a fish tender in the summer. He says he may just wait for those fisheries, but halibut quotas are also expected to be on a downturn, which doesn't leave much room for either halibut or sablefish to pick up the slack.
So yeah, just maybe a few lean years, you know, we'll just have to try to pick up as much long line quota as we can and maybe extend the tender contract or, you know, try to do whatever we can to, you know, maintain what we've been doing. But I think we're going to be well under what we've been bringing in for at least a few years here.
Others say next year's quota doesn't necessarily mean the season is doomed. Mike McCune manages the Fish Factory, a Homer-based processor, and McCune says he will keep the plant operating through February, despite the decline.
We don't know where the fishing's going to be good, where it's going to be poor. If the quota for the federal season is, of course, quite small. However, if the fishing is slow in other regions and relatively decent in our area, that'll allow for us to stay busy longer than the 80% cut would indicate.
The market may also compensate for the decline. Pacific cod hovered around 45 cents per pound in 2017. As for what prices might jump to, McCune says that's something he can't predict.
I've got no idea on that. If I knew the answer to that, I probably wouldn't have to work for a living anymore.
McCune doesn't expect a massive spike in prices because other cod fisheries around the U.S. and in other countries may stabilize the price per pound. But cod fishermen like Carroll say if prices jump to 60 cents per pound, that may help carry them through the winter months. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Sea Alaska Corporation's mission is to strengthen people, culture, and homelands. It pays its shareholders cash dividends and supports Alaska Native culture through the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute and other programs. But do Alaska Native corporations like Sea Alaska help their shareholders climb the economic ladder? KTOO's Julia Caulfield reports on how one family is engaged with Sea Alaska over several generations.
Sasha Ivan Sobolev was 26 when the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSA, was signed into law on December 18, 1971.
I was teaching in CAKE at the time, and I signed up on CAKE Tribal, so I have 100 original shares, and was on the original board of incorporators for CAKE Tribal. I also belong to Sea Alaska Corporation, because that's the large regional corporation.
Sea Alaska is one of 12 for-profit regional Alaska Native corporations the legislation created. It also created many village corporations, including CAKE Tribal. Alaska Natives at the time, like Sobolev, enrolled as original shareholders.
In general, do you feel like Native corporations can help people with economic mobility?
No.
Why do you say that?
Because the business nature of ANCSA Corps, which is the formation of an economic vehicle called a profit-making business, is not the way the culture of Southeastern Alaska Natives thinks or exist.
Sasha Sobolev was born in Juneau in 1945. That was 5 years after his parents, Walter and Genevieve Sobolev, moved back to Juneau from the Lower 48. He says his parents instilled in him the value of hard work.
They ran into terrible racism. They weren't allowed to rent. They weren't allowed to apply for jobs. But through their persistence, they started making it. And so the Sobolev family has always followed that mold.
Sobolev is a retired school teacher and principal. He's the grand president of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. He says the Native corporations fail to support the culture, and the distributions don't make up for it. Rosita Wuerl disagrees. Wuerl is also an original shareholder and recently retired from being a board member of Sea Alaska Corporation.
I can't believe I was on there for 30 years because it went by just that fast.
She says the purpose of the corporation is more than just monetary.
In addition to our economic responsibilities through employment and dividends, we also have a host of other responsibilities and things to meet our mission objectives, like scholarships, internships, things to grow, help our grow our shareholders so that they could lead a healthy lifestyle.
Nathan Sobolev, Sasha's nephew, received one of those college scholarships and an internship with Sea Alaska. Now he manages grants at Bartlett Regional Hospital in Juneau, where he has his own office. Nathan Sobolev got a few shares of Sea Alaska and the village corporation Kootsnuu from his father. Financially, they're not worth much.
I think I received a shareholder check of like $5 before.
He says what matters more is the connection to the land.
A lot of people do have strong feelings about having some kind of ownership, even if it's not in the modern sense of private ownership, but knowing that it's still Ha'ani, it's still our lands, is important.
Nathan Sobolev has 3 young children and looks forward to passing some of his shares along to them.
They are growing up being raised Tlingit Norwegians, and they culturally, they know who they are and where they're from. And in the near future, you know, within the next 6 or 7 years, I will give them some of my shares.
Rosita Wuerl and Sasha and Nathan Sobolev are just 3 voices among tens of thousands of shareholders in more than 200 Alaska Native corporations. In Juneau, I'm Julia Caulfield.
That story is part of Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America, an ongoing public media reporting initiative. December has been remarkably warm across the state. Temperatures in Fairbanks have felt more like Anchorage, Anchorage more like Juneau, Juneau more like Ketchikan, and you get the idea. Brian Brentschneider, with our Ask a Climatologist segment, says the state as a whole is likely to have the warmest December on record.
From south to north, east to west, everyone has been much above normal. And we're talking now, the numbers are in through, say, the first 18, 19 days of the month. Again, from Uptiakvik, Barrow, down to Ketchikan, and then from Nome all the way, say, over to Fairbanks and Eagle. Again, way above normal for everybody.
Have we set any records?
So many, many stations, perhaps even most stations in Alaska, are on track to have, or at least through the 19th, have had the warmest first 19 days of December. And then many of those places are solidly on track to have their warmest December on record. And then as a state, we're looking real good for having perhaps our warmest December on record as a statewide value.
And it's not unusual to have warm-ups in Alaska. What makes this one exceptional?
It's really the persistence. So there's been a few places that have had their, say, their warmest single day, like Juneau had their warmest high temperature, Bettles did, a couple other places did as well, Kotzebue. And Anchorage actually had their warmest single day if you average the high and the low. And we had a run of, say, four, I believe, days in a row of 45 degrees, which had never happened in any winter month. But it's the persistence. From, say, December 2nd onward, it's been much, much above normal across basically the entire state. And then if you look at the extended forecast out 8, 10, 14 days, which takes us through the end of the year, it's really looking quite warm, you know, way above normal.
And what's causing this?
Well, we talked a few weeks ago about the upper-level pattern, these Rossby waves. Well, we've had this wave, this upper-level area of high pressure that's really been anchored along the western part of North America. And we're on the left or the western side of that, and just the flow has been from the south. So it's been this kind of unrelenting transport of air from lower latitudes. Now, the flip side of that is, you know, in the central part of North America, Canada's been below normal. The lower 48's about to go into an extended period of below normal temperatures. But here in Alaska, we've just been stuck in that sweet spot for southerly flow and for warm temperatures.
And you said we're on track for this to continue for at least another 2 weeks?
So yeah, so specific forecast out past, say, 4, 5, 6 days, you know, we really start to get into kind of broad brush strokes. But the brush strokes are for extremely warm temperatures, much above normal. What the values are, too hard to tell, but there's really no end in sight until you get to, say, January for these remarkable conditions.
Brian Brenschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage. He checks in with Alaska's Energy Desk each week as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, please send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we are online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. Weird reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Hartball and Annie Fite in Anchorage, Rasha McChesney, Trip Krause, and Julia Caulfield in Juneau, and Aaron Bolton in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Thinking about completing your college degree? Good news, you can finish it right here at the University of Alaska. Go after your dream by earning a bachelor's, master's, a certificate, or an associate degree at the University of Alaska. Flexible classes, convenient schedules, affordable choices, and outstanding faculty, the university has it all. It's your choice, your dream. See how the University of Alaska can help you achieve it at alaska.edu/start here. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Public Media loves being part of your day. Thank you for listening and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.